Let's wait till the courtroom clears.
Good morning, Your Honor. Alan Morrison for the...
Wait till he closes the door.
Okay. Excuse me, Your Honor.
Here we go. Mr. Morrison and also Mr. Summers, we would like you to address jurisdiction. We have your supplemental briefs, but what we're interested in is whether we have jurisdiction or not. So start with that, if you would.
Since we are in agreement, I don't quite know how to proceed except to say that...
Well, you haven't convinced us, I guess.
I guess. Yes, that's right. as the court is probably aware, that when the case was originally filed, we did rely on 437H as the basis for jurisdiction. We then assessed the matter and determined, in our view, and in agreement with the Federal Election Commission, that 437H was an option that we could pursue, but we could pursue another option, which is using 1331, and we amended the complaint. Essentially, that was the only reason we amended the complaint, and that also to seek a preliminary injunction, which would have been much more difficult to do in the court en banc. We proceeded in the district court on that basis. 437H says may. It doesn't say anything about exclusive. Indeed, because of the structure of 437H, it includes only three categories of persons within it. One of them would be voters, which would include our plaintiffs in this case. But if there were an exclusive aspect to 437H, it would only be with respect to those three categories. And there are many other categories of persons who were affected by the Federal Election Campaign Act. And none of those could be required to go through 437H because the Supreme Court has held in the Breadpack case that 437H is expressly limited to the three categories of persons listed in there.
Have you looked at the legislative history at all? Have you looked at then-Senator Buckley's statements that they meant to sweep in everyone that they could think of that could bring one of these actions?
Well, I don't, that's not how I read Senator Buckley's statement.
All right.
He didn't say they're sweeping at everybody. Indeed, that would be directly inconsistent with Breadpack, where the court said it's only three categories of people and nobody else that can be brought in under 437H. It's not even optional for other people. In addition, Senator Buckley's concern was that the case be able to be brought quickly. That is, that the amendments to that statute be able to be brought quickly. The notion that he was forever locking in all challenges to the constitutionality of the Federal Election Campaign Act and requiring federal courts to certify to a circuit court. And by the way, one of the aspects of exclusivity argument here that doesn't fit with typical exclusivity arguments is that in most exclusivity arguments, the case goes to a single court. The way this 437H is written, you can file your complaint in any district court in the country where you have proper venue, and it goes to the circuit there. So we're not even having a centralizing function, and we're imposing burdens on full courts of appeals, en banc, a very awkward fact-finding process.
But that's all true whether it's exclusive or non-exclusive.
Yes, but that goes to the question about whether or not Congress would have wanted it to be exclusive with these out of extraordinary provisions, an additional burden on everybody.
Well, and the Supreme Court said with some confidence that Congress wanted it to be expeditious.
Yes. Well, actually, it's changed the statute somewhat now. It took out the provision saying it must be expedited in every case and giving direct appeals to the Supreme Court. So even that has been backed off a little bit. But I think the question is whether it wanted to be available to have it expeditious or whether it insisted upon being available to the exclusion of the general federal question jurisdiction.
And leaving the question of expedition or not to the plaintiff.
And yes, I think that's right. I think that's right. The plaintiff has a choice.
It seems to me the premise for this whole exposition, indeed this whole camel design structure, is to get these constitutional questions resolved in a quickly and in an orderly fashion, not to leave plaintiffs at large to to decide whether to go quickly or not and let a constitutional issue overhang an election.
Well, with respect, Your Honor, two things I would say. One is this is a statute which has been around since 1940. And so in that sense, it's nothing new. The second thing I would say
is... I'm not sure what that's responsive to.
Well, only in the sense that what Senator Buckley was talking about in 1974 was a brand new major change in the Federal Election Campaign Act. He wanted it, and everybody involved knew that there was going to be a challenge. Indeed, Senator Buckley was the lead plaintiff in that very case.
The provision under attack today goes back to the 1940 version.
Yes, I see. Yes, yeah. That, I'm sorry, Your Honor. I wasn't clear about that. And then, of course, aside from the fact this goes back to 1940, the challenges, there are many, many provisions of the Federal Election Campaign Act. And some of them are very important and require expedition, but many of them do not. And many of them have been litigated in a variety of contexts, some in which the FEC has brought an enforcement provision, for example, and a defense is raised that the provision you're seeking to enforce is unconstitutional. Everybody agrees that doesn't have to go immediately en banc to the Court of Appeals. Or similarly, if my clients have been subject to an enforcement proceeding at the FEC, and we had then gone to court and challenged the determination that the FEC made, everybody agrees that 437G would have allowed us to go to the district court and not required us to go to the Court of Appeals en banc. And so I guess I would say is, in construing this provision, that in the absence of either a word shall as opposed to may, the use of the word exclusive, as I pointed out in my brief, there is exclusive jurisdiction in the Federal Circuit, for example, with respect to patent appeals, that the exclusivity runs to multiple courts, a very awkward procedure. We should not expect Congress to have wanted, without over the objection of both the FEC and the plaintiffs here, to require that this case go immediately en banc to the circuit court.
Where's the may in lieu of shall that you're referring to?
I beg your pardon, Your Honor?
To which may are you referring?
It says in 437H.
So as may be appropriate?
No.
May institute.
May institute such actions?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. But having said that, the district court immediately shall certify.
If you choose to go to 437H, then the district court has no choice but to follow those procedures. But that doesn't answer the antecedent question as to whether everybody who's listed in that first group of three categories is required to go through 437H, even if the plaintiff and the defendant do not.
It seems to me, if that's the end of that point, that your invocation of, and the commission's invocation of precedent is not helpful here, that if anything, it undermines the suggestion of jurisdiction, in that we have one circuit that I believe having found a case before it in the same posture, simply referred it to the full court en banc, and no case resolving this in your favor.
Well, I think in the en banc in the Burt Lance case, the en banc court suggested, as I read the opinion, serious doubts about whether the lower court was right. And I should also, in fairness, point out that that case is even less attractive for en banc because it was a subpoena enforcement case. But the very fact that it could be used there suggests that the breadth of this notion of requiring en banc, as I read the Fifth Circuit opinion there, it actually seemed to me to think that the Ninth Circuit, which said it wasn't exclusive, had the better of the argument. But since it had already been certified en banc, they treated it, and the panel had already ruled, they simply treated it as a Rule 35 en banc proceeding.
Exactly, and they had no reference to this jurisdictional basis for it. They took it as Rule 35 as sufficient.
Yes, but they did, as I read the opinion, they did question whether they were right, and they said, compare it to the Ninth Circuit, which took a different view on exclusivity, and then said, well, we've got it here already, and we'll rule as we do, reaching the merits.
You're into your rebuttal time, are you not?
Turning to the merits of this case, Section 441C bans any...
You know, you're in rebuttal time. So it's up to you.
All right. Then I'll say what I was going to say at the end, which is, you've all read my brief, and the bottom line in this case is that Section 441C is like an ill-fitting suit of clothes. It's much too tight in where it reaches by sweeping in too much. On the other hand, it's much too loose because it leaves out corporate PACs, it leaves out LLCs. It was probably ill-fitting when it was passed in 1940. But in the meantime, much has changed. The Federal Election Campaign Act has been enacted. The creation for the PACs in 1976 for contractors, the expansion to include the LLC loopholes. In addition, government contracting has changed radically since 1940. And whatever may have been the case before the various significant amendments took place, it probably was not closely fitting at that time, but it's surely not fitting today. And if the Congress concludes that the suit is still needed to deal with the problem, it needs to do what it has never done, which is to focus particularly on the notion as to why we have this rule, which is to deal with the appearance of corruption, and to examine whether both what has been included is necessary and what has been excluded can be explained away, not on a mechanical view that corporations are different from their PACs, but in light of the purpose of the rule, which is supposed to be to assure against the appearance of corruption. And it's hard for me to understand if one reads even the FEC's briefs at pages 34 to 36, where they talk about the appearance of corruption, as to how the notion that it applies in the First Amendment context does not apply equally to the corporate PACs and to LLCs and the individuals who support them.
And perhaps reflects also on the need for expedition to dispel the appearance as quickly as possible or resolve it.
Perhaps.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Summers.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Harry Summers for the Federal Election Commission. We take a different view of the statute. We feel the tailoring that Congress has put in place is fully adequate to provide both freedom of motion.
You can address the jurisdictional issue?
I will, Your Honor. We generally agree with what counsel has already stated with regard to Section 437H. I would make a few additional points. One is that, again, the Bread Pack decision is very clear that the statute, that Section 437H does not apply outside the three specific categories listed in the statute in Section 437H. It's also the case that Bread Pack came after the Lance decision in the Fifth Circuit, to which Your Honor referred. So not only did the en banc panel in the Fifth Circuit at a minimum question whether the three-judge panel's conclusion regarding jurisdiction was correct, but those cases were from 1980, and Bread Pack was 1982. So Bread Pack's language, even beyond the three, for the parties beyond the three categories listed, strongly suggests that federal question jurisdiction generally, it provides a basis for
Actually,
even
I
those
thought
within.
In context, it was saying, don't worry if you're outside the three categories, you still have a means of constitutional redress.
That's correct, Your Honor. But the language gave no indication that the court felt that Congress's intent was to limit review to those three categories, because if there was no additional review, then it would effectively preclude other parties from bringing those cases. And at the same time, after Bread Pack, Congress altered the statute to eliminate the requirement for expedition, the explicit requirement, and to eliminate the provision for direct appeal to the Supreme Court. That happened later in the 1980s. Congress expressed no differing view of the reach of the statute, even following BREDPAC. And it's also the case that many courts of appeals have considered cases outside Section 437H, and the Supreme Court has also reviewed some of those cases.
Any reflections in those cases on jurisdiction?
The courts have an independent obligation, as you
I understand
know.
That. You know, that never carries the day. If it wasn't argued and resolved, it doesn't stand as a precedent for jurisdiction.
It's not binding, Your Honor, but we feel it is a strong indication in the 30 years of history since BREDPAC.
That Homer nodded, that's all it indicates.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
That Homer nodded is all it indicates.
I understand, Your Honor. So I would also emphasize that the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act in 2002 established another special review provision in Section 403 that was, for a time, mandatory. Special three-judge panels were set up, as the court knows. It is no longer mandatory, but is now only optional. If Section 437H were construed as the only method of challenging the constitutionality of the act, then it would create at least a surface conflict with the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act, which made no mention of the prior grant of jurisdiction. So statutes should be construed so as not to conflict, and that's another reason not to construe Section 437H as the exclusive method. Moreover, the general...
Just tell me quickly, where in your brief does this appear?
The reference to the bipartisan...
Yes, exactly.
Yes, that's page... Page 4, footnote 2.
Thank you.
I would add that the way that Section 437H has been construed as a general matter since it was enacted is to narrowly construe its reach, to limit the number of actions that may be put before an en banc panel, not only in the sense that it's only available to the three listed categories of claimants, but also in the many threshold determinations, or at least several, that district courts are to make in order to ensure that only substantial questions are presented. For example, the district court is to only certify questions that are substantial, that are unsettled. In the event that the district court determines that there's a need for a factual record, that there is a requirement that the court create a factual record, a lot of the cases, including California Medical, make clear that the Supreme Court has, and other appellate courts, have been very careful to limit the number of parties who are able to bring to get all the way to the en banc panel. There have not been that many cases, we believe something like a dozen, in which there has been a ruling on a certified question, but there have been many other cases, as we alluded, that have not gone that route.
Well, I keep coming back to Senator Buckley, and Judge Ginsburg raised it. That is, why, when you consider, and I am quoting Judge Buckley here, when he says, I am sure we will all agree that if, in fact, there is a serious question as to the constitutionality of this legislation, it is in the interest of everyone to have the question determined by the Supreme Court at the earliest possible time. It is the public interest that they were interested in vindicating, and not allowing the commission, the political committees, or most important, the voter, to decide, well, we're going to go to district court, we're then going to a panel, then it's going to be embanked, and then we'll finally end up at the Supreme Court.
Your Honor, I think the overall thrust and tenor of the legislative history that we've cited in our brief indicates some of what you're saying, that it was their intention to provide an expeditious way for constitutional questions that arose soon after the enactment of this large and comprehensive new statute. But the language doesn't literally preclude other options. And in fact, a lot of it, if you read the comments we've cited at pages 3 and 4 of our brief, I believe including from Senator Buckley and also Representative Frenzel in the House, talk about a method. It provides a method for review of these questions. And I believe Representative Frenzel's statement quoted at page 4 at the top of the page, it is a good idea to have a process that offers a chance for speeding review of questions on the bill. Again, none of these are determinative by themselves, but the overall tenor of the language suggests that it was a permissive grant. It provided a way for those who chose to pursue it to get this done, and not a mandatory one, saying that there was no other way.
Well, wouldn't BREDPAC then have said, not only are we saying that if you're not one of these three groups, you have other avenues, but these three groups have other avenues too?
I believe it wasn't, the group that was bringing the claim in BREDPAC was not one of the three groups. So the court's commentary beyond that, of course, would have not been necessary to its decision.
Right.
So.
Okay.
Well, we don't typically sidestep the Supreme Court's statements on the ground that they're dicta if we can avoid doing so.
Agreed, Your Honor.
I'm trying to make sure I get your argument carried out in the footnotes of your brief, footnotes 2 and 3. In footnote 2, to which you referred me a moment ago,
yes,
you portray what you, or you describe what you've portrayed as a conflict, saying statutes should be interpreted so as not to conflict. Whereas in footnote 3 at page 7, you quote portions of the Supreme Court's case in McConnell, the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act case, suggesting that the court has acknowledged the difference and not treated it as a conflict.
Your Honor, I believe that quote does not treat it as a conflict, but the court was not addressing the issue that...
So again, it's a dictum.
I believe
it may be a dictum, but it's dictum.
It's their dictum.
Therefore,
it's
our dictum.
But it's important to realize, I think, to note that it wasn't addressing the specific interplay between the two statutes. And I think that because the BCRA BICRA was creating modifications to FECA, the Pre-Existing Larger Act, in fact, by its terms, all of those provisions would also be subject to review under 437H, under the interpretation that 437H was the exclusive grant. So there would have to be some way to reconcile this new grant of jurisdiction in the 2002 law with the pre-existing grant. It may be that they can be reconciled. It may be that there's a way to interpret them, but it would appear to create a conflict if two different, if Section 437H was exclusive, and then Congress many years later says, here's the way to resolve some of, at least some of the challenges to some of the provisions of the Act, that creates a conflict. So,
well, why? Is there any one provision that would fit both?
Yes. Everything that the BCRA did is part of FECA.
Yeah.
So Title I, the soft money ban, Title II, the election and communication provisions, and some later sections as well.
So
they all became...
Supreme Court seemed quite untroubled, though, by saying, you know, BCRA basically revives the old Expediting Act structure, right? Three-judge district court, direct appeal.
Yes, Your Honor. Essentially, for only the modifications to the pre-existing act that were created by the McCain-Feingold law. That's right.
Yeah. And then the court observes in the course of reviewing that, that interpreting 437H, it's in this other footnote, the court has no power to adjudicate a challenge to the FECA limits because challenges to the constitutionality of FECA provisions are subject to direct review before an appropriate en banc court of appeals per 437H.
That's what the court said, but the court was not purporting to fully describe the scope of jurisdiction of Section 437H.
Granted.
All that the court really had to find there was that the review provision for the BCRA did not apply because the challenge really went beyond. So in that case, I mean, there are other examples of cases where courts have made references to Section 437H, but none in which any court squarely addressing the issue that's binding here has said Section 437H is mandatory. And the history of the legislative history, the history of how courts generally have approached it, indicate the opposite, as well as the general interpretive trend to narrowly construe extraordinary grants of jurisdiction.
I'm not sure that this is fair. Mr. Morrison will correct me if it's not, but I drew the implication from his argument about changes occurring since 1940 that we should read the statute in light of those changes, that is to say, it may have been narrowed from what it meant when it was enacted. And I wonder, I'm not sure that I've got his argument right, but if that's correct, do you agree with that?
I'm not sure I understand the point.
That basically the meaning of the statute has changed, the 1940 statute has changed and been narrowed by virtue of subsequent legislation and practices among federal contracting.
When you say the statute, do you mean Section 441C, the substantive provision?
Yes.
I'm not sure I would agree.
I think that's what he was addressing, yes. You were addressing? Okay, well, I withdraw the question. I withdraw the question, and Mr. Morrison will just sua sponte clarify.
All right, we have your argument. You want to just wind it up?
I will, yes, thank okay. you. Just a few things to note on the merits, Your Honor. We do believe that Section 441C is constitutional. It's for more than 70 years, deterred corruption and promoted a merit-based federal workforce, which is an independent reason under the letter carrier's decision that it can and should be upheld, in our view. It's important to remember that the statute applies only to those who have chosen the benefits of government contracts, that there's always a potential in any large, complex system like federal contracting for corruption and for coercion, and that there are numerous examples that show that these concerns continue to exist in both the federal level and the state levels, which it's appropriate for this court to examine. So we'd request that uphold the district court's grant of summary judgment. Thank you.
Let's see, Mr. Morrison, you've used your time. Why don't you take 1 minute?
I have nothing further to add, Your Honor.
Okay. We have your arguments. Thank you. Thank you. Can you all stay here so I can swear my clerk in?
Oh, yes.
I can swear my clerk in, yeah.